Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of Seas of Opportunity, Navigating the Blue Economy. This is a collaborative effort between the Marine Conservation Society and Simmons & Simmons, exploring the many different elements of a blue economy from a finance, policy, and in this case, a scientific perspective. I'm James Merchant. I'm the Marine Natural Capital Analyst at the Marine Conservation Society. And in this episode, we want to look at the bigger picture and consider why the ocean is so essential to our life on planet Earth. And to help us do this, we are today joined by Dr. Helen Chersky. Helen is a physicist, an associate professor at the University College London, a science presenter for the BBC, podcast host, and author who last year published Blue Machine, How the Ocean Shapes Our World. Thank you for joining us, Helen.
Thanks for having me on.
So to start with, to many people, the ocean may be out of sight, out of mind, maybe a big inert mass of water or completely separate world removed from our life on land. We are, however, entirely dependent on the ocean and very much living on an ocean planet. And you even wrote in Blue Machine that we are tiny ants living on the shores of a big fluid mechanism and completely dependent on its output. So my first question is, at a very high level, why is the ocean so fundamental to life on Earth?
Well, we talk about us being dependent on it quite a lot, but we don't ever talk about why. And the reason it matters is that the ocean is not just blue filler with fish in it, which is how it's normally presented. It is a three-dimensional engine and it is doing things. It's moving, it's turning over, it's turning around, and it's moving things around all the time. And the way it moves and the way this engine turns is it's not only what sets the context for planet Earth, but it also affects the things that move around on Earth, like us and animals. And if you want to know, you know, where things feed or where things can travel, including humans, the fingerprints are everywhere. You know, the signature is written all over our history. It's written all over the way animals behave. And once you really start to look, you can see the influence of this engine on almost everything we do. So the point is that it's not that the ocean is just where the fish live. Fish are very nice. I have nothing against the fish, but it's kind of a bit like talking about a human purely through, you know, one organ, through their kidneys or their liver. And actually, you've got to look at the whole thing to see how impressive it really is. And so the critical message is that the ocean is doing things and they matter.
Yeah, you did reference there that it's not just the fish that are in it. And when we do look at ocean science and conservation, we often do talk about specific ecosystems, species and habitats and the wonderful things that they do and the need to protect them. But the majority of the biomass in the ocean is largely invisible to us, right? So why is it that part of the ocean that we cannot ordinarily see that is so important to the functioning of the ocean?
Well, it's not just the life that's important, actually. So the physics of the ocean is important. So the way the water itself actually moves is critical. It's the physics that sets the context for the biology, because, of course, the ocean also drives our weather to a large extent. It provides energy for the weather. And so it's the physics of the ocean that sets the energy. And then life lives within the sort of environments that the ocean creates for it. So it's not the case that the ocean is just the same everywhere, that it's just kind of blue and then more blue. Features like the upwelling and plenty others give the ocean anatomy. Different parts of it have different characteristics created by this turning engine. And life in the ocean is navigating through this anatomy. It's going to certain parts of it and not to others. The turning of the engine is important inside the ocean because it's the physics, it's the way it turns and the way it moves that allows life to exist in some places and not others. That means you have the equivalent of rainforests in some places and deserts in others. But also for us up on land, the ocean is the big buffer. It's the big energy buffer so that, you know, we can go overnight when we're facing away into space, away from the sun, and we've still got enough heat to keep warm. And equally, when we're facing the other way, we don't overheat. You know, the water is absorbing energy. So it's kind of buffering it's sort of smoothing out the peaks and troughs in energy that are coming from the sun. And so once you've got a big engine like that, we're all kind of living in its shadow and we're living within the environments it creates.
Absolutely. Do you think we could expand on that element a bit more about the ocean basically being a giant thermometer for the planet and why it's going to be such an important ally when we're talking about climate change and making sure that we have an inhabitable Earth?
The temperature on Earth is basically set by the amount of energy in the Earth system, because all of that energy, most of the vast majority of that energy is stored as heat. So if you add a bit more energy, you make it a bit hotter. And the reason that the ocean matters is because it helps hold that very stable, partly just through water changing into ice or gas, but partly because water is a very powerful greenhouse gas. No one ever talks about this. It's a natural greenhouse gas. It's not one of the ones that are causing problems. But it gives us this blanket that keeps us stable. And so if you're basically, as long as the amount of energy flowing into Earth is the same as the amount of energy flowing out, the amount of water in your cup stays the same. The amount of energy stays the same. So the temperature stays the same. But as we start to heat up, as we put extra carbon dioxide, an unnatural greenhouse gas, if you like, into the atmosphere, it will cause us to heat up even more. It will slow down the flow of energy away into space. And so energy accumulates on Earth. And that's what climate change is. So the ocean is sort of sits as a buffer in the middle of this, these energy flows. And it helps us out, like, you know, in a couple of ways. First of all, it absorbs, so 93% of all the extra energy we've put into the Earth system because of climate change has gone into the ocean. But it also helps us because we've put a huge amount of extra carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and the ocean has absorbed some of that. If it hadn't, we'd be way past the Paris climate targets already. Now, that's not consequence free for the ocean. So the ocean has done us already two massive favors. It's held on to some of the heat, and it's held on to some of the carbon dioxide. Now, it keeps them away from where we are. But those also have consequences. Those changes have consequences for the way the ocean itself, for the way the engine functions. And so it's all kind of woven together. But the heart of it is the physical nature of the ocean. The biology kind of lives within the physical engine.
Okay, so it's all being driven by this physical element of the ocean. I think you've painted a pretty compelling picture within a few minutes of why we are so dependent on it. We are living on an ocean planet, but I would argue that our society and our economy functions with a huge blind spot when it comes to the ocean and this absolute dependency we have on it. So for you, what are the most fundamental things we need to get right as a society, economy, or across industry to make sure that the ocean can continue to provide us with this function and to support life on Earth?
The biggest thing we have to realize is that the ocean is already doing something. So if you put something in the ocean or take something from it, it's not a neutral act. It's not like, even if it's something like a wind turbine, you know, offshore wind turbine, which is generating renewable energy, great. It's not consequence-free because the ocean was already doing something in that place. And so it may well be that you choose to take the trade-off. But the point is, if you can't treat the ocean as something to just put things into or take them out of, or just you, anyone who uses the word just in association with the ocean, I tend to have not a lot of time for, really, because they don't understand how complex the system is. But the point is that the ocean is already doing something in that space. So don't treat it as though we can just put things in the ocean or we can just take things from the ocean, because the real trade-off is look at what's already happening in that space and then see if we can afford the balance. So in the case of an offshore wind turbine in a shallow coastal sea, which is already well mixed, I think we can afford the balance, right? It's a very good trade in the sense that there's lots of mixing already. I think a few wind turbines isn't going to change that much of it. And of course, you need to keep studying that. But fundamentally, you get renewable energy, and that is much better than burning fossil fuels. But if you talk about, you know, trying to fertilize the ocean in places or farm in places or add things to the ocean, it's changing the way the ocean functions. And so you have to look at what it was already doing there and what you're doing is going to change. You have to ask the question, what was the thing of value that the ocean was already doing in that space? Because there always is something. And what's it going to affect downstream? And what's it going to affect, you know, in different seasons? And you have to look at that. And the other thing we can do is we can talk about the ocean as though it was a place. And we have to start seeing it as talking about its features, not just talking about it as this place called away, where it's some other, you know, some disconnected away, and we can just put things away and then we don't have to think about them ever again. So it's partly the talking and it's partly this mental shift. And then the final thing, which is sort of part of the first point, is that, you know, the big challenge for our time is to stop fighting against our planet. We have to understand how this big engine, the planetary engine, not just the ocean, this big engine is keeping everything going. We want to work with it, not against it. So we need to understand what it's already doing and find ways to engineer our world so it works with those things rather than fighting against them. And so, you know, planet Earth has two rules, basically. And rule number one is that the energy flows through, comes in from the sun, hangs around from a bit, carries on out into space. And rule number two is that the stuff, the atoms, go round and round. And if you don't keep those two rules in mind, everything you do is completely pointless, basically, because, you know, those are the rules of Earth. And if you try and break them, there will be serious consequences. And so we need to think about, you know, engineering our future and the changes we make to our systems more as kind of operating on a living body rather than just plunking ourselves on top of a landscape, which is the way that engineers and economists have traditionally thought about it.
Yeah, certainly. And you've referenced elsewhere as well that we've basically been treating the ocean like a giant dustbin. And whenever you put anything in the ocean, it's not going to be without consequence. But we do know that finance does flow into the ocean in different ways. A lot of it flows into more extractive activities. We want to see it going into more regenerative activities. Have you got any thoughts on where you want to see money moving away from and flowing towards in order to protect that ocean health?
So I think I would like to see money flowing towards, and maybe a scientist is always going to say this, like before a project occurs, understanding what's already going on there. So it's quite common, I think, for someone to go, oh, I want a seaweed farm. I can see some ocean out there. I'm just going to plunk my seaweed in there. And I think you shouldn't be able to do that without asking questions about, well, what effect is that going to have on the rest of the system? So, and that's money that is not seen at the moment as investment, because it's kind of finding something out. But in the long run, it's the only way to invest, because otherwise your seaweed farm is going to cause more problems somewhere else, which are going to be expensive to fix. So I think floating wind has huge potential benefits. I mean, the biggest way we're damaging the ocean is just by accumulating extra energy on Earth, right? Because the extra energy the ocean's absorbing is actually changing the structure of the ocean a bit, and that is going to have consequences for us. So things like floating offshore wind potentially open up wind energy to far more places, to places that haven't got so much of a shallow coastal shelf seas. But also you haven't got a pylon, and you haven't got, it's not nearly as intrusive on the sea bottom. So that's something. So that kind of thing I think about. I think any kind of farming in the ocean has to be treated with extreme caution. I have never, and I haven't spent a huge amount of time investigating every example, I've never seen an example of a larger scale farm that is really working well for the environment as well as for the farmer. You know, fish get diseases, you have to feed the fish, other fish that you've caught from somewhere else. No one ever talks about where the food for the farm fish comes from. You then take nutrients from the local area that deprive something else downstream of nutrients. You know, you change ecosystems. And so I think just putting things in the ocean because you want one there, because it's convenient for humans, is something we should be a lot more cautious about. I would think much more about the way when we put something in the ocean, it's more a case of like surveying that bit of sea and saying, what's already going on here, given the engine turning underneath, where does it make sense to put it? Not just, oh, let's put it there because it's a convenient distance from shore. So it's more the way we treat the ocean, I think, because what really bothers me is that people see the ocean as the next extractive sort of space. Oh, well, you know, we've taken all the things from the land. We just discovered an ocean. Let's take things from it. And we know it doesn't work, right? It's ridiculous. So, and there's that thing that it was probably somebody famous who said it, but, you know, you're not going to solve a problem with the same thinking you use to cause it. And so every time someone just says we're going to take something from the ocean, that is the same thinking. that was used, if you don't start with some understanding of Earth system science and the fact that there's a system, not just a local problem, that is the same thinking that was used to generate the problem. So it's less about specific types of things and more about how we think about the things that we do.
So it's one part is reducing the impacts that are already taking place, but then whenever we consider getting involved with the marine environment, we have to know that it will have an impact, and the better we can understand it, the better place we will be, and not just see what happens afterwards. So this has admittedly been a huge topic to try and cover in about 15 minutes, but to try and finish on a positive, there's a lot the science is telling us about ocean health. A lot of it can be quite scary. What gives you hope for the future, and what seeds of progress would you like to plant?
So the thing that gives me more hope than anything else, actually, is that, you know, so I've been making TV documentaries and talking about science for years now. And 10 years ago, whenever I said to someone, I want to talk about the ocean, they go, can't you talk about astronomy instead? Right. And I've talked about so many topics. But 10 years ago, people didn't think there was anything to know about the ocean because they thought it was all about the fish. And now I see that changing. And what is even better is that the public are kind of, there's this awareness that it's probably not as simple as all that. So when we're starting to see these, you know, technologies proposed that may or may not help, and quite often the first response of the public is, hang on, this has probably got a consequence you're not telling us about. Can you tell us about it so that we can make a decision that takes all the trade-offs into account, not just the ones you want us to see? So I think there's much more awareness that we need a different way of looking at things. And I find that is the biggest thing is we have to talk about it. We have to talk about it and take it seriously. And I am seeing a huge shift in attitude and a huge amount more. You know, I work at University College London, and we have companies coming to us, basically beating down our door saying, tell us how to do this better. And so even if it's not emerged into the public yet, there is a huge amount of very productive thinking going on in universities and in research organizations, you know, asking the question, how can we do this better? So I think that's really positive. And then I think also it is basically the maturity of approach that people are suspicious of simple solutions. And I think that is very healthy to be a bit suspicious. Like, all of us want a magic pill, right? Everybody wants some magic pill that's just going to make all these horrible problems go away. But almost all of them are probably too good to be true. And I think that suspicion is very healthy, and it's helping us ask the right questions. Like, we're starting to look at the long-term consequences of what we're doing much more, and to really take that seriously. And really, the only problem is that we haven't found a way of quantifying it. So at the moment, a company can do a good thing. You know, they might do a good thing which perhaps reduces their revenue by 1% or something, which might be quite a lot for them, depending on their profit, you know, margin. But at the moment, we don't really have a way to measure that. We don't really have the way to say, thank you. We recognize that you have taken a positive step and it cost you something and we benefit, but you don't. And so I think people are trying, but we need to find better ways to recognize when companies, especially companies, do the right thing. And I also, finally, on the positive thing, politicians are paying a lot more attention to the ocean. And I think that is a positive step because it means they're thinking more about how to regulate it. Like, how do we think about who chooses what we do in the ocean and who chooses who it benefits and who gets to decide? And I think there's much more pressure on politicians to consider the ocean as a place. And that's very positive as well.
I think you're absolutely right. And we're finding the exact same thing, both from politicians, a lot more curious to understand the ocean, and then also industries and the finance sector looking to understand their impacts and their links to the ocean. But as you say, measuring it is not always easy. So maybe that's somewhere to focus our attention. So thanks very much, Helen. Hopefully we've managed to give a flavour of the huge fundamental importance of the ocean. And if you want to understand more about this, I can absolutely recommend reading Blue Machine and following Helen's work more widely. All that's left to say now is a big thank you to you, Helen, for joining. A big thanks to everyone for listening. And please do look out for our next episode of Seas of Opportunity coming soon. Thank you.